We are now ready to hear our first case for this morning, Kimberly Hively against Ivy Tech Community College. And I believe we will hear from Mr. Nevins first.
Good morning, Chief Judge and members of the Seventh Circuit. I'm Greg Nevins, and along with John Davidson, both of the Land Legal Defense and Education Fund, we represent Ms. Hively in this case. It is our citation to Supreme Court authority and Ivy Tech's response that tells this court all it needs to know about how to resolve this case. In our briefing, we cited no fewer than five cases with standards and holdings specifically about the proper interpretation of Title VII's sex discrimination provision that is irreconcilable with the immunization of sexual orientation discrimination. We also cited at least another half dozen Supreme Court cases, all decided after this court's decision in Hamner, all holding that courts should entertain all Title VII claims within the language of the statute and not erect any barriers or exclusions because the court prefers bright-line rules or wants to avoid results that are either undesirable or not in line with what the court thinks Congress wants. Ivy Tech's response to this is notable in three ways. First, it simply dismissed the sex discrimination-specific cases that we cited as too old to help us. Then, it not only ignores the more recent authority, but also repeats the exact error condemned by the Supreme Court in those cases, that of urging courts not to apply the literal words of the statute because it would, quote, result in, or, quote, have the effect of covering sexual orientation discrimination.
So could I ask you, Mr. Nevin, let me just quickly ask you, and then you can turn to Judge Rovner, whether you, in your view, there is one broad category, sex discrimination, that might manifest itself in various ways, including discrimination based on sexual orientation, or whether you see sexual orientation as something somehow different from sex.
I think the simple question answer to that, Your Honor, is that the Supreme Court has said if you're being treated differently because of your sex, then it qualifies as sex discrimination, even if there's a colloquial phrase that might be more familiar to people. For instance, sexual harassment. The usual target of sexual harassment is may not come home and tell their closest friend, I've just been discriminated against because of my sex. Because, in fact, in that person, there may have been all kinds of other reasons why, like in the classic example of male-on-female sexual harassment, that woman was targeted. It may be that she worked more conveniently the same hours. She was considered more attractive or more interested, whatever it might be. The fact is that she was a woman, and that was the reason why she was discriminated against. So in the same way that just because we have a colloquial expression called sexual orientation discrimination that is more familiar as to how we describe it, it doesn't change the basic truth that what is being held against my client, her attraction to women, is something that was not held against any men who worked for Ivy Tech.
So you're saying essentially this is just a but-for test, you know, but for the sex, this wouldn't have happened.
Yes, that, as this court said in Shepard, and I would also say that, you know, we're not we definitely prevail under a formalistic sense of what constitutes sex discrimination, but it's not just merely formalistic sense. I mean, one of the purposes of Title VII, as has been said many times, is to strike at the entire spectrum of disparate treatment of men and women that results from gender stereotypes, and this clearly is in line with that. So whether you look at it from a formalistic sense or whether you look from it as being coherent with the actual purposes of Title VII, this is sex discrimination.
Now, thank you.
Yes.
Although it's certainly true that congressional inaction can be a hazardous basis for inferring the intent of Congress, it's also true that Congress has again and again refused to expand the reach of Title VII despite numerous court decisions refusing to interpret sex to include sexual orientation. Can we make anything of that at all?
And if I could, Your Honor, I'd like to focus to two aspects of your question. First off, as a matter of statute, as a matter of interpretation of what the word sex means, this court in Ulane said that it just means that what Congress has done and not done says that sex just means male or female. Well, we're not here to re-argue that point. We're fine with that. But OnCall says that as a statutory interpretation matter, you do not, you don't concern yourself with what Congress, the specific intent of the 88th Congress that passed it, and it can't possibly be the case that by issuing a unanimous decision in OnCall that Justice Scalia was inviting the court to guess at what the 89th through, what are we now, at 113th Congress did not intend to do by not passing these laws. So as far as a statutory interpretation matter, this court should not be trying to divine what Congress wanted to cover and not cover.
So are we placing too much power in the judiciary to amend the word sex to include sexual orientation when we know that this was not the initial intent of Congress, and Congress has shown no affinity for altering its interpretation of sex in all these ensuing years? So help us with that.
Your Honor, indeed, what we're asking for is just the opposite. We want the court to apply the terms of the statute and then let Congress pass. If Congress wants to pass an exception, they already know how to do that. In fact, they did do that with the Americans with Disabilities Act. They said no matter what this law covers or doesn't cover, it doesn't cover sexual orientation discrimination. It doesn't cover gender identity discrimination. They have not done that here. The Supreme Court has said over and over that they've given you basically a pass that says if you, and I think maybe the most dramatic example of that is in the Lewis case, which was just decided in 2010, in which this court very ably noted that the results the plaintiffs were looking for, I think the court here said it would lead to ludicrous results of people being able to wait a long time and sit on a cause of action. The Supreme Court didn't disagree with that at all. They said they didn't call it ludicrous. I think they called it puzzling. But they said, don't worry about that. If it leads to a result that Congress didn't want, that it leads to a result that you think is inconsistent, that is not your concern. Let Congress sort that out. If you apply the law and cover everything cover all the claims that are covered by the terms of the statute, you're doing your job, and it's up to Congress to do their job in passing any exclusion.
Now, Ivy Tech relied on the Ulane case, which was decided before Price Waterhouse. I just want to get a sense of the scope of the position you're arguing. In Ulane, the plaintiff was a biological male who took hormones, had gender reassignment surgery, and then presented to work as a female. Could she state a claim under your theory now, under Price Waterhouse?
Well, it can't be argued that some of the principles that a decision in our favor would underline and would spell out would be in favor of a person in Ms. Ulane's position. For instance, the idea of defining a statute by what it means and not being concerned about what Congress specifically intended or what later Congresses didn't intend, that would obviously help Ms. Ulane as well. But basically, I mean, as the panel opinion aptly pointed out, you don't need a broader definition of sex than male or female in order to recognize that sexual orientation discrimination is covered. For instance, if it's okay for a man to be attracted to women, and it's not okay for a woman to be attracted to women, you don't need a broader definition of sex than male or female. In the same way, what would be the inevitable argument is, for instance, if someone named David Schroer was given an offer by the Library of Congress, and the exact same person saying that they were showing up as Diane Schroer got that offer was reneged, undoubtedly that person would say it was discrimination because of sex. I don't think this court needs to reach that. That's a decision for another court as to whether it would absolutely necessarily follow, but it can't really be disputed that the principles that are at issue here do overlap in some respects. So
I wonder if you could say a word or two about sex stereotyping, which was one of the aspects discussed in our panel opinion. Is it discrimination on the basis of sex to take an adverse employment action because somebody doesn't conform to sexual stereotypes?
It definitely is, Your Honor. And under
Hopkins, right?
Under Hopkins, right. And of course, what some courts have done is tried to limit the types of gender nonconformity to exactly what Ann Hopkins, in the ways in which she was, didn't conform to gender stereotypes. But that's wrong for a couple of reasons. One, the Supreme Court specifically said in Price Waterhouse, they repeated the line that Title VII strikes at the entire spectrum of different treatment based on gender stereotypes. But that wasn't just dicta. That line came from the Manhart decision, at least came from it from a Supreme Court standpoint. And there, the quote-unquote stereotype that was at issue was that women live longer than men. Well, that's not just a stereotype. That's an actuarial fact if you look at women in the aggregate. But what it means is that any individual woman might not live longer than the man who's her coworker. And so making her pay more into the pension fund because you are going to generalize about her and say, well, she's going to live longer, that's what's wrong. So any nonconformity with a generalization about a sex is actionable under Title VII, and it's not just limited to if the nonconformity manifests itself in the demeanor or the appearance.
So the question then becomes, is what's the difference, or do you see any difference between sex stereotyping and sexual orientation?
I don't know whether I can improve on I believe the panel said that the notion that women should be attracted only to men is the quintessential stereotype. We submitted a supplemental authority to this court recently that talked about it in terms of the prototypical stereotype or the ultimate stereotype. Whichever way you look at it, I mean, you think about the various stereotypes that people have about the genders, and they're true a given percentage of the time and not true an awful lot of percentage of the time, and it really doesn't matter. But it is true that there are gender norms that are related to, you know, women should be attracted to men and only to men. And if you transgress that stereotype and you're discriminated against because of it, that absolutely should be covered under the Price Waterhouse theory.
Well, one of the arguments you make is that we should overturn Hamner because it doesn't provide a clear framework for lower courts. But doesn't Hamner provide a clear framework that sexual orientation is not a protected trait under Title VII?
Well, and again, as I mentioned in all the cases that came after Hamner in the Supreme Court that we cited Lewis, we cited Thompson, we cited Ash, we cited all those cases. They all said that a preference for bright line rules is not a good reason to deviate from the text. So that would be my first response. But also, in reality, I think when you look back on it, there was an observation in the panel opinion about how common it is for the American people to think that federal law already covers sexual orientation discrimination. And you think about why that's so. It's because, employees go to these trainings and they're taught, well, you can't discriminate against a woman because she drives a Harley or because she has bear season tickets or because, you know, she has tattoos. And so if they're told that, oh, but you can fire her because she's a lesbian, well, of course they think that can't possibly be the case under Title VII. So what you have is an incoherent framework. It's just internally inconsistent. So whether you look at it from a bright line rule, which the Supreme Court has condemned as if it's within the terms of Title VII, or just trying to come up with a coherent framework for what should be actionable and what shouldn't be under the notion of gender stereotype discrimination, I think we prevail under either approach. The idea that because of the cases that we rely on are old and vintage really shouldn't distract this court for long. Twice this court recently in bank cases, in the Block case, it overruled a Fair Housing Act case from 2004. And the only Supreme Court case it cited in support of overruling it was the Trafficante case from 1972, 32 years earlier, which I think it illustrates that this court understands that its overriding obligation is to make sure that its interpretations of statutes are in line with Supreme Court authority.
I thought, yes. Go back to your earlier point, that your argument was that your proposed rule was in fact a simpler, more bright-line rule than anything that Hamner or other courts have come up with, insofar as it simply asked, would this person have received the same treatment if everything else had been the same, but they had been of quote-unquote the appropriate sex, as opposed to worrying about whether there's kind of a legislative history-based exception to the word sex for sexual orientation or sex stereotypes or sex or characteristics that are not universal in a sex, and so on.
And I'm certainly not here arguing against the bright line rule that if a man is treated different, if a woman is treated differently for the exact same thing that a man is acceptable for, that is the bright line rule that on-call supports. That's also specifically what the court said in Manhart. They articulated the quote simple test that but for the sex, the treatment of the person would have been different. And this court cogently reduced that in the Shepherd case to also treatment of a person which would have been different if they hadn't been the sex that they are. So that bright line, I'm not saying that we're against bright line rules. We're just against something that the Supreme Court has set up as a test for what sex discrimination is and trying to come up with a bright line rule that says some of those are okay, are actionable and some of those are not. That's where the problem lies.
But has the Supreme Court ever defined the word sex either to include or not to include sexual orientation?
No, Your Honor, it has not. But and our argument does not depend on that. And quite frankly, I think that that is where a lot of the older precedents went astray. They assumed that if sex was defined as the sex that you have, I mean, as the sex that you are instead of the sex that you have, that my position loses. And
isn't
that's
a stereotype built into that, that if you are biologically, you know, female, then you must be attracted to men?
Yes, absolutely, Your Honor.
That's certainly an orientation stereotype that goes along with the biology.
Yes, Your Honor, it is. It is. So, and again, all we are asking for, under the narrowest definition of sex is male or female, our position prevails. So, I would also say the later cases that we cited, I would also remind that especially the Lewis and the Thompson cases were both unanimous Supreme Court cases that did urge that also said you're supposed to entertain all the cases all of the claims within the title within the statute's reach and not to be concerned about the consequences. So, for instance, in the Thompson case, there was a concern that if we allow third party retaliation claims, we're going to open the door to all kinds of claims, and the court said no. We understand that concern; it's a legitimate concern. But under the interpretation of the statute, those kind of claims are covered, and we're not going to allow a bright line rule to exclude some of them and not others.
Of course, we know about the new Scott case, November 4th, out of the Western District of Pennsylvania. Are there any more of these Title VII sexual orientation cases that you're aware of that are sitting in district courts awaiting rulings?
There are several cases that are up before the Second Circuit that will be heard next month. Those are the Zarda, and there's the Zarda and the Christensen case, and later the Magnuson case will be heard. But the Evans case will be argued for the 11th Circuit on December 15th, and that involved a woman who was discriminated against both because of her gender nonconformity and also because she's a lesbian. So the 11th Circuit will be hearing that in 15 days hence. Again, and I want to talk about the interracial relationship analogy, and the panel opinion accepted on as being on all fours, but didn't believe it could overrule the precedent of this court. There were only two responses that were offered by Ivy Tech. One was to say that race discrimination is different, and of course, from a historical standpoint, from a social standpoint, and even from a constitutional standpoint, that is the case. But Ivy Tech doesn't offer any authority as to why it would be different under Title VII. Indeed, there are no fewer than four Supreme Court cases that say because the statute treats them all in parallel terms, that the discrimination must be treated the same. True in Meritor and on-call in Price Waterhouse and in Farragher versus City of Boca Raton. Also, they try to change what our argument actually is, what our claim actually is, and say that, well, this is the same thing as discrimination against a Caucasian heterosexual because he goes out with a lesbian for drinks. Well, that is obviously not what Ms. Hively is claiming, and a plaintiff does get to talk about who the comparator is. But even on its own terms, that analogy doesn't work because, and there are three different precedents of this court under each of the theories that explains why that's So in the Drake versus 3M case, it was this court, and still the leading case on this point, that it doesn't matter what the level of intensity of the relationship is. If a white employee is discriminated against because he or she has black friends, then, well, that may make the claim a little less plausible and a little more difficult to prove, but it's still a claim under Title VII. Under the Belliver case, that was a case where a woman said, well, I was discriminated against because I was considered hard to get along with, but you know, all the men who were hard to get along with, they didn't have a problem with that. This court said, well, you know, that's not quite as gender laden as what happened to Ann Hopkins, but it doesn't matter. I mean, if something was held against a woman that wouldn't have been held against a man, then that was sufficient. And then in the Orton Bell case, in one of the more interesting and unusual examples of a claim of discrimination that where the woman employee said that the other workers were having sex on her desk, and only because she was a woman, this court said, well, you would have a claim if that was actually true and it's because you're a woman, or if the hierarchy wasn't responding to your claims because you were a woman, and they were responding to similar complaints by men, but factually it didn't pan out there, which goes to show that it's not a matter of it doesn't matter what it is that is held against a woman that's not held against a man. If that results in an adverse employment action, then Title VII is violated.
Let me ask you, just sort of a hypothetical. If a claim is actionable under the associational theory, should an employee be able to bring a Title VII claim if the employee is not in a relationship or actively dating?
Again, and I think the Drake versus 3M case answers that, which is that the level of the intensity, whether it's just an interest or whether there's an actual relationship, whether there's an actual marriage, is not relevant. And I think that I can't improve on what the panel said on that point. The nature of this kind of discrimination is it is the same. In other words, something's being held against a woman that's not being held against a man. So, yes. I'll save the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
All right. That would be fine. You must be Ms. Coleman.
May it please the court, I'm Gail Coleman for the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. Title VII prohibits sexual orientation discrimination by its plain language. This court is not being asked to add a new protected class to the statute, and there is no need to alter the original understanding of sex as meaning because of being male or because of being female. We're not asking for any judicial amendment. What we're asking for is a more precise understanding of the term sex. This is consistent with what the Supreme Court has done with the statute. It is possible, in Ankhal, the Supreme Court said it is very likely that when Congress passed Title VII, they did not intend the word sex to encompass same-sex harassment. In fact, we know that Congress may not have intended sex to encompass opposite-sex harassment, but the statute has now been understood that sex is defined in a broader way. In Baldwin, the EEOC offered three explanations for why the word sex includes sexual orientation discrimination. The first of these reasons comes from Price Waterhouse, and it is that under Title VII, if someone is discriminated against for failure to conform to a gender norm, that is sex discrimination. The quintessential failure to conform to a gender norm, as this panel recognized, is the failure to conform to the expectation that men will be attracted to women and women will be attracted to men. So even if you have a lesbian who, for example, dresses and appears in all other ways to conform to gender norms, she still isn't, because she's violating the basic assumption that she will be attracted to a man.
What's the right comparison group?
The right comparison group is, would this woman, who is being discriminated against for her attraction to other women, be discriminated against if she were a man who is attracted to other women?
That doesn't hold everything constant in the analysis. Ordinarily, in anti-discrimination analysis, we look to others similarly situated of the other sex, if we're looking at a sex discrimination claim. So you have to hold everything else constant. So why isn't the relevant comparison group here? The plaintiff is qualified, female, gay, So why isn't the relevant comparison group qualified male, gay, as opposed to just qualified and male?
The statute it protects individuals. It doesn't protect groups. So that
right, we always look for another employee who shares every relevant criterion
with
the plaintiff, except for sex.
And this is where the racial analogy comes in. If an employer discriminates against a white employee for having an interracial relationship and also discriminates against a black employee for having an interracial relationship, it's not true that the discrimination against one cancels out the discrimination against the other.
No,
they both have claims.
The right comparison group in that analogy is the interracial couple, the employee with an interracial marriage, for example, or an interracial dating relationship, and an employee with a same race marriage, not just the opposite.
Well, that's right, and that would be the comparison to the employee with a same-sex relationship versus an employee with an opposite-sex relationship.
But we're trying to isolate the motivation of the employer for determining whether a forbidden criterion is the motivating factor for the employment decision. So in the case of race discrimination, we're trying to look to evidentiary facts that tell us that this motivation was racism and not some legitimate reason. And in sex discrimination claims, we're looking for evidence that will tell us, or tell a reasonable fact finder, that sexism is the motivating reason for the employment action, not homophobia, as the allegation is in this case.
Well, that's assuming, again, that homophobia is something different from because of sex. The statute doesn't say sexism. It says because of sex. And you cannot even define who is gay or lesbian without thinking about their sex in relation to the sex of the person that they are attracted to. So
sex and sexuality are the same for purposes of Title VII analysis.
Sex. We're not talking, we don't have to talk about sexuality. We have to talk about
sex and sexual orientation.
If this employee's sex were different, would the employer object to their relationship with this other person? If this employee were a man with a picture of his wife on his desk, would that be okay? Whereas if this employee is a woman with a picture of her wife, that's not okay. So that is solely because of her sex. If her sex were different, she would be treated differently. I would note that under Title VII, it is appropriate to look at subclasses within a sex. For example, an employer cannot treat women with small children differently from men with small children. It's not all women who are being treated poorly. It's women with small children, but that is still illegal.
Okay, I think your time is about up, so we thank you very much. Mr. Maley.
Thank you, Chief Judge Wood, members of the court. May it please the court, my name is John Maley, counsel for Ivy Tech Community College. The starting point in Title VII analysis is, of course, the language of the statute. As the Supreme Court has held repeatedly, and this court has held, that term here, sex, means gender, male or female.
But tell me, please, how sexual orientation discrimination is not discrimination based on the failure to adhere to norms about gender, including who a person loves and with whom they have a sexual relationship.
Yes, Your Honor. This court has held that sexual orientation is not within
but
the ambit.
But we're here to reconsider, so maybe you could answer Judge Rovner's question at a deeper level.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. I will endeavor to do that. In the sexual orientation focuses on desires of that particular person, heterosexual, homosexual, asexual, bisexual. It does not focus on whether they are male or female.
But why isn't that about their sex, though? I mean, you're quite right. This court has said in a long line of cases that these are two different concepts. Your opponents argue that the Supreme Court has never spoken to this. I can think of lots of examples of instances where the courts of appeals went off on the wrong track in terms of statutory interpretation, and the Supreme Court kindly said, maybe you all thought this, but now we're going to set you straight. So in the Bailey case, they did that with regard to use of firearms. They did that in, you know, the Buchanan case. They did that in Milner. I mean, they've done that now and then. They've said, now we're speaking. So in that kind of a world, I think we need to ask why the word sex in the 1964 statute all along shouldn't have been understood in this broader way than the Ulane court did.
Your Honor, several reasons. First of all, the Supreme Court, as acknowledged by a plaintiff's counsel, has never said that it includes sexual orientation. And the Onkalka decision, for instance, references within the decision sexual orientation. The court certainly is aware of that terminology.
But don't you see a trend in the Supreme Court? You know, we start out with things like, you know, mothers of small children and so on. But then we get to cases like Hopkins on Cal, and the Supreme Court is saying to us, we've been trying to tell you not to delve into the collective mindset of Congress. Some people even think that's impossible to do.
Doesn't have one.
And, you know, we have the court's language in UNCAL saying, yeah, they may not have thought of this, but so what? The word is there. We need to apply the statute. Why doesn't that take us to the simple rule, the kind of, if everything else had been the same and the sex of the individual had been different, would this have happened?
Well, Your Honor, first to start with, this court's precedent on stare decisis asks, has there been an intervening high court decision?
And there have been. I'm saying Hopkins and Onkal point you in a different direction from Ulane.
And in 1989 and 1990, this court has addressed those decisions since then and has addressed what the court acknowledges sometimes can be challenging.
Counsel,
maybe difficult.
I'd like you to focus on a different intervening decision. It's Loving against Virginia from 1967. State law bans marriages between a black person and a white person. And the Supreme Court holds that that is race discrimination. Now, here we have an employer's ban on relations between a woman and a woman. Why isn't that sex discrimination by exactly the reasoning of Loving? Loving is raised by your adversary, and I notice your brief doesn't mention it. So I would like you to address the significance of Loving.
Your Honor, as I recall, Loving being a constitutional decision, I believe, on marriage.
And the Supreme Court holds that that's race discrimination. It's also told us that race discrimination and sex discrimination in Title VII mean the same thing, just substitute one for the other. So I'm asking you to substitute homosexuality for different race marriages and to discuss whether the rationale of Loving doesn't control the treatment of the word sex in Title VII.
Your Honor, revert to the Supreme Court's decisions in Pricewaterhouse Hopkins and on call that focus and tell us that.
I am asking you about Loving against Virginia and would appreciate it if you would address the significance of that case.
In that case, addressing the constitutional issue that the court certainly so held, it does not translate, though, into its interpretation of the term sex within Title VII, as Congress used that term.
But why not? The question is, why not? Because I don't think you're arguing that the prohibition against discrimination found in the Constitution is broader than the prohibition in the statute in Title VII. Most people have understood it to be the other way around, insofar as we have disparate impact theories under Title VII. But just for this straightforward intentional discrimination theory, you can't just stand there and say, well, it's different. You know, why?
Mm-hmm. Well, the language of the statute.
Look, you seem to think that the meaning of a statute or meaning of a constitutional provision is frozen on the date of enactment. Is that your position? Because,
no.
Of course, that's false. I mean, Loving is an example.
Yes.
In 1868, when the 14th Amendment was passed, they didn't think that, you know, they were creating a right to have interracial marriage. They assumed it would, you know, be forbidden. And similarly, you know, 1964, the date of Title VII, that's a long time ago in terms of how people thought about sex, and in particular, how they thought about homosexuality. So you think we're bound by what people thought in 1964 in interpreting the statute more than a half century later?
No, Your Honor, not. That is not our position, as the court and this court have interpreted.
That's how you started out. By saying that, you know, the statutes, 1964, they understood sex to mean the gender, you know, that you're born with.
Well, you're the Supreme Court has told us in Hopkins and on call that sex means gender, male or female. This court has used that precedent.
They didn't actually say that in either Hopkins or on call, in fact.
Well, they have told us, respectfully, Your Honor, that the test is whether the male would be treated differently or the female
exactly.
would be treated differently.
Exactly. And so that's the test that I think that's tricky for you. And I might add, this is just an aside, really, that it's very odd to me that Ivy Tech is here, since your brief says, and I take this as a given, that Ivy Tech deplores discrimination against same-sex people with a sexual orientation that's not heterosexual. And so you're not one of these companies or entities that says, no, we actually don't even think this should happen. But I'll put that to one side. I guess you're defending against the transaction costs of litigation, so I'll take that. But it is a little odd.
I appreciate that, Your Honor. In this case, of course, presented at a 12B6 motion testing the legal theory pleaded by plaintiff of sexual
right.
orientation.
Right, and you said we deplore sexual orientation discrimination, but we're going to defend our right to do it anyway.
At the procedural level, certainly, Your Honor, and they have Ivy Tech has a policy prohibiting discrimination against on the basis of sexual orientation.
Right,
as
that's
well.
The thing that's a right. little strange.
Why do you think they're lesbians?
What was the question?
These particular people,
What do you think people are?
Why do you think there's this type of person?
The case law has cited to...
It's not a case law question.
I don't understand.
What is the cause of lesbianism?
It's now a mutable characteristic is what medical professionals say.
It's not just ugly men, huh?
I'm sorry?
It's not just ugly men.
That's right. So it has become an immutable, it's been understood now to be an immutable trait of a person, whether heterosexual, homosexual, asexual.
Look, probably
genetic or biological or maybe early childhood effects. Why doesn't that make them really a different sex?
Yes, you're correct, Your Honor. The modern science and the case law now treats it as not a choice. It's a mutable trait. The case law has dealt with this.
But if it's part of your genetic makeup, doesn't that make you significantly different from other women? You're all women, but you're very different. And you're different in a way that's built into your genes, just like the more common preference of women for men is genetic. It's not that they chose it. You know, that's how we're born. That's how the race evolves and so on. So now they're recognized to be a lot of homosexuals, lesbians, male, and so on. And why doesn't that create a real differentiation in the sex of the normal woman and the sex of the lesbian? They're different. They're both women, but they're very different types for reasons that are probably genetic. So it's not a casual sort of, you know, choice that people make.
Respectfully submit, Your Honor, that this type of question is why this is designed for Congress to address sexual orientation.
No, look, that's the business about being frozen on the date of enactment. You take something like the Sherman Act. Sherman Act enacted in 1890. For the last 30 years or so, it has been interpreted in accordance with modern economic understandings of monopoly and competition and so on. Now, that the modern understanding did not exist in 1890. So here's a statute being interpreted in a way that the framers would not have understood, let alone could possibly have intended. And when Justice Scalia voted to classify burning the American flag in a political demonstration as a form of speech, you think he was simply going back to what 18th century people thought when they said free speech in the First Amendment? Oh, free speech, yeah. Burn things, sure, that's a form of speech, right? So constantly the judges are reinterpreting statutes in a way that is not consistent with the actual thinking of the people who enacted the statute.
Agreed, Your Honor, in this court's case law,
Supreme Court's. Why isn't this a perfect case for that?
This court and the case law acknowledges that you look in the current context, that you look at the current context, but the point of the discrimination of male versus, whether it's a male or female, that is still the gender that we are with today, and it would be a matter for Congress to address sexual orientation.
But that's actually the question before us.
All
I think
these statutes, which come to have a different meaning over time because of the change of how people understand things, you could say that about everything.
So
you could say that about the Sherman Act. You could just say no, it's for Congress. Always Congress has to correct a statute. Judges can't do it.
So before you respond, I think Judge Williams may also have had
Well, I mean, just following along in this same line, you're relying on Kyle, but the specific language there says statutory prohibitions often go beyond the principal evil to other reasonably comparable evils. So taking the case you're relying so much on, that very language is there that speaks to the point that Judge Posner is getting at. And you don't seem to have an answer.
It is a challenging question, Your Honor. I acknowledge that this issue is developing both scientifically, the medical acceptance, the social acceptance of this issue. I would respectfully submit that makes it an ideal issue for Congress, which has been attempted with Congress over and over. Sexual orientation is used, for instance, in the hate crimes and has never been added to this.
But today you are here, and I have a very simple-minded question.
Yes, Your Honor.
If a woman would not be fired for dating a man, but would be for dating a woman, why is that not just discrimination based on sex, plain and simple?
The reason, Your Honor, is because it's based on the sexual orientation of preference as opposed to what the gender is, because
Why?
It's a woman or
I don't
male.
Understand that, though. She, but for the fact that she isn't a man, she gets fired. I mean, she...
It brings you back to the loving problem.
Yeah, it does take you straight back to loving.
Does religious doctrine have any play in this particular statute?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Does religious doctrine have any particular play in this statute?
Of course, religion is off limits under Title VII, but the
so case, is sex.
Yes, Your Honor, and the case law talks about the fact. Go to Price Waterhouse that Congress has specified what is off limits and leaving to the employer free choice otherwise. So, for instance, Congress has included familiar status in the Fair Housing Act, but not in Title VII. Political association is not protected. So.
But our issue, I mean, we understand that, but fundamentally we're here to try to decide whether that word sex in the 1964 legislation, properly understood, encompasses the kind of situation that Ms. Hively faced encompasses the kind of situation Judge Rovner has described. If you started from the premise that sex and sexual orientation are two different things, then your argument flows just fine. Sexual orientation isn't there. But that's not the starting point. The starting point is, what does that word sex encompass, especially in light of the later Supreme Court developments in Loving and you know, the other cases we've been discussing?
Can I put this in the form of a question, I guess? I think all of us recognize that if we were to extend Title VII to sexual orientation discrimination, that's a pretty significant expansion of what has been understood to be the scope of the statute. But given Price Waterhouse against Hopkins, which I find most compelling here, Price Waterhouse against Hopkins seems to tell us that it violates Title VII to discriminate against a woman because she looks gay and behaves outwardly as somebody who is gay. I have a hard time drawing a principled distinction between discrimination against somebody for looking gay and for being gay, and would invite your answer to that.
Yes, Your Honor, that has been a challenge for the courts, and as this court has noted in Ham, for instance, that may be difficult. And
so in a sense, it's only the phonies that get protection, right? The ones who are the real.
It is an odd situation, to be sure, Your Honor, but that's where Congress has left us, just as with...
Congress has, I mean, the problem, look, Judge Rovner's opinion for the panel explains in considerable detail and just how difficult and arbitrary this line has become in the case law. And that has been a powerful argument. And I guess I would ask for your help in how do courts draw the line you think we should draw without sounding arbitrary and occasionally silly.
First, this court, as it addressed it on case-by-case basis, has done that, just as in each case, whether it's summary judgment or trial, has addressed that, or here, based on these pleadings. It's not always going to be easy, but that's the work of the courts to do that. And to the extent that stare decisis says the fix would come from the Supreme Court or from Congress rather than this court overruling prior precedent that is consistently held through the years that sexual orientation is not covered.
I take it that you would concede
What's wrong with rejecting precedent?
Well, stare decisis gives us, the Supreme Court tells us, and this court tells us, gives us an important part of this branch of predictability and certainty and importance.
No, I don't think that's right. What the significance of precedent is that often you have you have reliance on it. You have companies that do one thing rather than another because they feel that the court has given them, you know, the meets and bounds of what they can do. When there are strong reliance interests, that's a strong argument for retaining a precedent, unless the precedent is doing significant harm in other respects. Okay, but where in this are what we're discussing today, where is the strong reliance interest on retaining an obsolete definition of sex? Who's going to be hurt if the lesbians and male homosexuals have a little more job protection?
Fair point, Your Honor. In fact, the business world is increasingly adopting policies like Ivy Tech that prohibit discrimination on sexual orientation. South Bend, where the plaintiff lives, has an ordinance against sexual orientation discrimination. So the stare decisis...
That is not my question. My question is, what reliance interests would be destroyed by recognizing the word sex, you know, in Title VII as embracing sexual orientation?
Your Honor, I'm unable to identify one. If this court were to do so within this circuit, employers would adjust accordingly and treat this as prohibited.
I'm sorry, I don't understand you. What are these reliance interests?
I'm not identifying it. I'm unable to identify
one. If there's no reliance interest, what's the big deal about adhering to a precedent? The purpose of the precedent is to induce reliance, provide guidance, okay? If it's not doing that, why stick with it?
Well, the Supreme Court precedent also tells us in stare decisis that it's part of importance of the court and not revisiting decisions over and over again.
What's wrong with revisiting a decision? If you're not going by doing that, if you're not going to, you know, wreck people's businesses and throw them off course because they relied heavily on this.
It certainly lessens that importance, Your Honor. I acknowledge that.
And oh, Pricewaterhouse and on call, do those cases really leave us with a strong precedent in this court for the position you know that you have had to come here and espouse?
There have been these series of cases that this court has pronounced that address, and two of them address and deal with Pricewaterhouse. The Supreme Court has not accepted certiorari in those and four other cases from other circuits.
We know that means very little, right, of course. Mm-hmm. The court repeatedly tells us not to put much weight on
so
that.
So to get back to what Judge Rovner is asking, so would under Pricewaterhouse, the plaintiff in Hamner who complained that his supervisor would flip his wrists at him and lisp at him, or in Ulane, again, the plaintiff who was a biological male who took hormones and had gender reassignment surgery and then presented to work as a female, wouldn't they both have claims under Pricewaterhouse? Because those were decided before Pricewaterhouse. So we have to take into account the evolution of the law, and Pricewaterhouse speaks right to those issues. They would have claims, wouldn't they?
Well, Ulane certainly was decided prior to Pricewaterhouse.
Right. So the question is, would they have claims now under Pricewaterhouse?
Under Pricewaterhouse, to the extent that the gender stereotyping would be actionable, yes, Your Honor.
Yes.
But the subsequent decisions have been able to walk this difficult line that the court is left with in terms of sex orientation,
so
and gender stereotyping.
If they would have claims, you and Ulane and Hamner would have claims, then why should we rely on those cases and not look at Pricewaterhouse? That's driving the train here, isn't it?
Certainly Pricewaterhouse is critical guidance from the Supreme Court, and this court has addressed Pricewaterhouse in Spearman and in Ham subsequent to that. Last point I'd like to make, Your Honors, is that this is an important issue, obviously, that society is dealing with. It goes before the legislature regularly. The courts are dealing with it, and would urge the court that in this particular case where we don't have these other facts, in this case we have a very straightforward complaint that alleges sexual orientation. So we don't have that difficult line to draw here. Because of any stereotyping comments, as the court has had in other cases.
I take it you would concede that if Ivy Tech promoted gay men to a full professorship, but not Ms. Hively, that she would have stated a claim. For sex discrimination, as our case law understands it, separating sexual orientation from sex discrimination.
Yes, Your Honor, going to the comparators, as you questioned earlier, yes. That, Your Honors, we ask that respectfully that the court affirm the decision below. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Anything further, Mr. Nevins?
Just a couple of things, Your Honor. I was struck by Judge Posner's question about whether a broader definition would be might be appropriate. I would say that I look back at a major opinion of this court of a couple of years ago, and equal protection of the laws did not have to have a broader definition, but just a better understanding, an evolving understanding that what once was unthinkable now is. It used to be the case that when we had marriage equality cases, if we saw the opinion say something about court's proper role or the welfare of children, that wasn't a good sign for us. But
I should think you would rather argue that the original understanding was mistaken rather than has evolved.
Well, and here, of course, I'm arguing again, as I said, Your Honor, for the most limited definition of sex as male or female, and just a recognition that it cannot be okay to hold it against a woman for dating women when it's fine for a man to do it.
And you might recall that in Ulane itself, although this court drew the distinction. The district court judge had not done so. If you go back to the district court opinion,
I do remember that judge.
Judge Sykes's point about maybe the district court judge was right and we went off on the wrong tangent.
Right, and you're trying to make a textualist argument for your interpretation of the term sex discrimination in the statute, and Ancal tells us that unexpected applications don't defeat a textualist interpretation.
That is correct, Your Honor.
So
that
you're
is
not
absolutely
moving
correct.
Off of that argument, I take it.
I'm not detracting from that. That is the basic argument. That is the simplest argument. So, yes, so essentially just a recognition that the most basic understanding of these terms with the blinders taken off can lead to the result that we need, and that's all that we need. Thank you, Your Honors.
All right. Thank you. Thank you to all counsel. The court will take the case under advisement, and we will recess briefly before the next case.